Hi, this is David Rutledge welcoming you to the Philosopher's Zone, and it's great to have your company. Over the past few weeks, we've been taken on a journey of discovery with new dad Matthew Beard. He's also a philosopher and an ethicist, and as such, he was startled to discover that not a lot has been written by the sages down the ages on parenting and children and families. Well, becoming a first-time dad really shook him into action as a personal project and a public one via the Philosopher's Zone. Here he is with part three.
Every parent knows it. The guilt that comes with being a bad parent. You've lost your temper at your child. You gave in to a tantrum. You spoiled your precious little angel. Now they're going to learn bad habits. They won't make friends at school. They'll fall in with the wrong crowd. They'll probably be a sociopath. What have you done? Perhaps the most important philosophical questions parents ask are the ethical ones. What does it mean to be a good parent? What's the right way to raise our child? Today, on the Philosopher's Zone, we speak to two philosophers who have waded into the goods and bads of parenting. Norvin Richards, he literally wrote the book on the ethics of parenting. It's aptly titled, The Ethics of Parenthood. Norvin, before we talk about the ethics of parenting, it might be helpful to define our terms a little bit. So what makes someone a parent in the ethical sense?
It might actually be helpful to start even earlier by defining parent and what it is to be one. The term can be used biologically, as you know, so that a child's parents are the people who played certain biological roles in his coming to exist. On a different way of speaking, a child's parents are the ones who play a certain role in his life, one in which they are parents to him or serve as his parents.
If we focus on the second question with regard to the responsibilities of people once they are parents, what's the role of biology here?
Under some circumstances, the fact that you're a biological parent of a child can entitle you or give you a right to be a parent to the child in the time to come, but that it doesn't automatically do that. The only thing it automatically does is, again, under most circumstances anyway, make you responsible for some of the costs. You have a responsibility either to be a parent to the child or to find someone who will be.
Is there an ultimate purpose to parenting that we can use to kind of hone our ethical judgments?
One central duty of parenthood is to help your child become a good person who is equipped to have a good life as an adult. There are lots of ways to do that, and parents have a lot of latitude, in my opinion, in the way they do it. So to at least a great extent, your rights as the parent of the child are rights to be the one who does this for the child and does it his way. Not an unlimited right, and what the limits are is an important question. That's a partial answer. One reason it's only a partial answer is that it seems to treat childhood as nothing more than a training period during which the eyes of the parents should always be focused on what lies ahead for the child when she becomes an adult and never on what it is like for her now, except insofar as that affects the way she's going to turn out. That can't be right. Childhood is a time of life in its own right. So the question for parents is a much harder one. It's how to balance what would be good for the child as a child with what it would be good for the adult she becomes to have had happen back when she was a child. There's much more to being the parent of a child than being the one who has a certain set of rights and duties where she's concerned. Being her parent also offers opportunities, including the opportunity for an intimate relationship of a unique kind. That relationship between parents and their children can be imbued with love that is at least as deep as romantic love and often more durable than romantic love. It's like that when things go at all well, and this is an excellent good for both parties. That's all part of parenthood as well.
There is a creeping kind of instrumentalism that can come into parenting, which is to say we will do the thing which works in the long term, and it's always seen as a long-term game, but some of the short-term sacrifices of that on the child's behalf can be quite severe. You know, we want them to sleep through the night, so we are going to let them cry and be distressed for a period of time.
Right.
You know, it goes from the micro to the macro in terms of decision-making. So how do you check against that? How do you find a balance between dealing with the child as they appear in front of you and addressing the adult that they will ideally become?
Yeah, this is extremely difficult. There's an autobiography by the tennis player Andre Agassi. He talks about having been raised to be the superb tennis player that he turned out to be, and he hated it at the time, and he didn't like it much when he was a tennis player either. If you say, well, you have to take into account what it's like for the child at the time, there are different perspectives. There's what the child thinks of it then, feels it as then. There's what the child comes to feel it as, what he regards it as later, and that can change over time. So if your way of going at this is that I think it's appealing to say, what matters is what it is like for the child, that's what we ought to be paying attention to as well as the long-run consequences, then there's what it is like for him at the moment, what he regards it like at later dates, and what he regards it as at later dates can change. So the Andre Agassi at 16 might think, hey, yeah, you know, I didn't like it at the time, but now I think that was a good way for my dad to raise me. And then the Andre Agassi at 21 might reverse that again. And so might the one at 40, and so might the one at 60. So there is a difficulty of deciding which of the children, so to speak, counts.
Agassi was famously had a number of difficulties in his life, you know, with regard to his sexuality being kept under wraps, with regard to drug use, behavioral problems, you know, in the professional arena. Now, there would be those, especially from, say, the psychoanalytic tradition, who would say that you cannot separate the child and the way the child processed that upbringing and the behavior of the adult. So even if Agassi, on a rational level, claimed to say at some points, well, I think this was the right way for me to have been raised.
Sure.
There would be those who pointed to the behavioral evidence as a suggestion that perhaps that child who had at the time not enjoyed that experience is now integrated into Agassi's identity and is continuing to push back against and respond to the ways in which he is living and the ways in which he was taught to see and experience the world.
Yeah, that's an extremely sophisticated point. Thanks. What you're saying is you can't separate the Andre Agassi who's 8 years old and who just hates it, that his father's making him drill all the time and wishes his father would just love him and demonstrate this and accept him however he happened to be. You can't separate that Andre from the Andre who's now 25 years old and raising hell. And maybe having a hard time in life. That's a sophisticated point. I don't have a good way to deal with it.
When my partner and I first decided to become parents, we decided in doing that, and when we had the conversation, we agreed that one of the consequences, morally speaking, of that decision was that our needs and our desires would no longer hold moral priority in our own lives. Is that a reasonable expectation to have of parents?
Being a good parent certainly requires some redefinition of what's important to you, and that actually happens automatically for a lot of people. And it also requires some sacrifices for the child's good. Whether what it requires along those lines is captured by saying, our needs are always trumped by the needs of our children, partly depends on what you mean by a need and on whether some needs are more significant than other needs. You could say that none of that matters. If you did, you'd be saying, whenever a choice must be made between something that would be good for my child in any way and what would be good for my child's parent or parents in any way, the parents would always be wrong to go with what would be good for them. I don't see why that would be true. And if it were their practice, it might fail over time to teach the child some valuable moral lessons, that he is not the center of the universe, that what matters is the claim and not who has the claim, and that some claims are more important than other claims.
So that temptation to make a virtue of sacrifice or to make a virtue of suffering and say that, well, part of what it means to be a good parent is to be to have my aspirations kind of suppressed and repressed and to almost hold that as a badge of honor, as these are all of the things that I sacrificed for you, my child. And we do hear stories of when sure. parents will use that to as a trump card against their children once sure. they are adults and say, well, I've put my needs second for so long. You're actually saying, well, we need to we need to take a step back and be critical of the assumption that that was even something that was necessary or good to do in the first place, which perhaps gives children a possible response to their parents when they start to throw that at them.
The natural response for the child is, who asked you?
Yeah.
I never asked you to make those sacrifices, and I wasn't in a position to prevent you from making those sacrifices, so it's all on you. Of course, if it were the right thing for you to do, then that wouldn't be of any significance. But I think sometimes, I mean, it's obviously there are times when parents should sacrifice for the sake of their children. But I think there are also times when it's perfectly legitimate for the parent to say, I know it's going to be painful to you if you have to leave your school friends behind and move to this new city. I know that's not what you want, and it's going to be painful to you. But if we don't do that, then my career is over.
Okay, but that's a question of collective interest, right? Because the child will suffer if the family's income disappears. So maybe another scenario would be to consider a child who is exhausted and desperately wants to go to sleep, and two parents who haven't had a chance to socialize with friends and family. And so the child is being dragged along to a party that, you know, they really don't want to be at, that they are absolutely exhausted. Now, that's a case where some people would be tempted to say that's an abdication of parental responsibility there, to drag an exhausted child out for a social gathering. And yet there would be some parents who say, this is the first opportunity I've had to see my friends in 6 months. So that seems to me to be one where it's not as obvious whose needs should trump.
It seems to me to be a matter of the claims rather than who has the claims. It isn't as though it's obvious what a parent ought to do in every situation, or what a parent ought to do in a really hard situation. Sometimes it just isn't. So all you can do is come up with reasons why you might do this and reasons why you might do that, and then you have to sort of throw up your hands and say, well, I guess we'll do one of those.
Norvin Richards, thank you very much.
Oh, you're very welcome, Matthew. I enjoyed the conversation.
So we've heard one story about what makes an ethical parent, a balancing act between the child's claims and ours, and between the child's needs now and their needs in the future. But what specifically should we be teaching our children? What kind of person should we hope they turn out to become? And what kind of person do we need to be in order to succeed in that project? And what about the gender question? How should we raise boys? Should we dress girls in pink? Do mums and dads have special jobs raising boys and girls? Nin Kirkham, lecturer in philosophy at the University of Western Australia. She wrote an essay on the virtues of motherhood, which made me want to pick her brain for every skerrick of parenting advice she can spare.
Hi, I'm Nin Kirkham, and I work at UWA in the philosophy department.
And Nin, what framework do you think is best suited when we're doing ethics to work out the ethics of parenting?
So this is a difficult question, actually. Obviously, you expect me to say virtue ethics, and I will, but I think I don't want to be misinterpreted in saying that, to think that every ethical question can be solved within the framework of virtue ethics. I think the other approaches have a place, especially with respect to the ethics of parenting. If we're thinking about, you know, parents' rights or something, you know, deontology is going to be appropriate there. We're thinking about the distribution of various social or welfare goods, utilitarianism is going to have a place. But generally thinking about how to be a good parent, I think virtue ethics is going to be the right place, because it gives an account of moral education, and I think moral education is core to the process of parenting.
So one of the points of virtue ethics that I think sometimes gets forgotten, and you've already brought it up when you talk about moral education, but is the importance that it puts on role models and moral exemplars. The idea behind virtue ethics is that we learn the virtues because we imagine what a person who is already virtuous would do, and ideally we've learnt because we've been exposed to one of those virtuous people. And that seems like a really important point when it comes to parenting, that part of what it means to be a good parent is to be a good role model for our children. But the challenge there is, as a parent, who do I look to as a parent for my moral exemplar, so that I can then be that moral exemplar for my child?
That is really challenging because often as we grow up, our parents are seen, you know, by us as having done everything wrong. You know, we'll be a better parent than they are. It's not until we have our own children that we start to see the kinds of challenges that are particular to parenting and understand and put in perspective the things that our parents did and the choices that they made. So I think our own parents act as a moral exemplar in some sense, but there's lots of other options as well for kind of examples of good parenting.
What are the particular virtues that we should look for examples of?
Let's look at them. Endurance. It's important for a parent to recognise that parenting is a long-haul activity. It's a big job. You never stop once you become a parent. It's a one-way deal. Perseverance is essential because it's a long task and we have to realise that the decisions that we make today are ones we're going to have to be responsible for in the future with respect to our children.
Because oftentimes when people think about, you know, the idea that what we do today has consequences down the track, they're thinking about the discipline of their child and they're thinking about staying consistent to their parenting philosophy so that their child kind of succeeds and thrives and becomes the right type of person in the long run. But we do need to moderate that approach a little bit.
I'm sure you've had these experiences as a parent.
Absolutely.
You know, what battles you're going to fight.
And which tantrums you will indulge and which tantrums
you
won't.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. It's a question of finding a balance between the things that we, you know, really insist on and think we can control and the things that we need to let go of. That's a big challenge with parenting, is that it's such an intense activity, but the purpose of the activity is to let the child go.
You mentioned that your account has kind of changed as your children have gotten older and as the type of parent you are has changed. So are there virtues at this stage in your parenting experience that you think have taken more of a priority than the ones that were relevant to you at the time you were writing the essay we're talking about?
Well, probably. I've got teenagers now, so patience is important in a way that it probably, in a different way from what it was early on. I was reading an essay the other day. This is not about patience, but it's just about parenting, really. And it was talking about a distinction between transforming love and accepting love. So I think, again, finding a balance there between the love that accepts a child for the person that they are, for the personality that they come with, the talents that they have, and the transforming love that helps them to develop those talents and that personality, especially when your children are older and starting to show clear signs of particular gifts or talents or interests or ways of being.
One of the major frustrations that I've found, or one of the major challenges that I've found, I think, is in balancing parenting, which is a full-bodied and wholehearted commitment in terms of a moral commitment. It's all-consuming. But yet there are other obligations in our life and there are other spheres of activity that I need to dedicate time and I need to dedicate moral energy to. So Alasdair MacIntyre thought that there were different spheres and that there were different virtues for these different spheres of activity. So the virtues of a chess player are different from the virtues of a boxer because they're engaged in different activities. And I think that's why I found it a bit challenging, because different spheres of activity require different virtues. So the virtues that I'm required to embody in professional life or when socializing with friends or when I'm alone with my partner are quite different from the virtues that I need to embody when I'm being a parent. That seems like a bit of a challenge when the different spheres of activity require us to embody different virtues.
Yeah, look, I think it's an interesting point you make, and I'm not sure how much I agree with MacIntyre about that account of practices, different virtues for different arenas. I think perhaps we could say something like this, that in different arenas we embody the virtues in different ways. I don't think the virtues themselves change that much, really, with respect to the different spheres that we operate in. I suppose I want to maintain that the human virtues are basically that, shared among humans. Yeah.
One of the challenges that I faced before I actually was able to even hold my son was in thinking about how to be a moral exemplar with regard to gender. In the first instance, I found out we were going to be parents and that was wonderful and that was exciting. And then we found out that we were having a boy. And suddenly something changed for me in the way that I thought about this, because suddenly it was not just about teaching my child to be a good person. It was teaching my son how to be a man. And this is a challenge, I think, for virtue theory, because sometimes the virtues tend to be co-opted so that some virtues are seen as gendered. So men should be more stoic, they should avoid outward displays of affection, and women should be more caring, they should be more compassionate, they should be more intimate. So what it means to be a virtuous man is different to what it means to be a virtuous woman. So do you have a sense of the ways in which gender and virtue intersect around these kind of issues?
Yeah, I mean, what you say is true. Virtues have been co-opted to kind of make differences between the genders. I don't know how much I'd want to endorse that. I think that's problematic. Like I said, I think that, you know, we share a set of virtues among humans, whatever gender or, you know, categorisation they want to lay claim to. But it is a challenge of being a parent, is being a moral exemplar with respect to, say, the gender that your child has, you know, whether as a mother, you know, you want to be a moral exemplar for your daughter so that she knows how to be a good woman in some sense. I mean, I think it's just as important for a mother to teach her son to be a man in some sense of that as it is for a father to do that, and likewise with fathers and daughters.
I think it highlights the difficulty of the question, because it brings us into some of the really fundamental questions at the moment around the nature of gender and whether it is constructed and whether it is essential and whether it indeed means anything at all to say that we are a particular gender or that our sex should determine the way in which we ought to be in the world. But these seem like questions that are really fundamental for parents to wrestle with.
They really are. They are. And they're very challenging. It's very hard to deny that there's a biological difference between males and females. But gender is not biological sex, you know, in some sense. I don't know how far you want to take it. It's in some sense a cultural and social construction. So how much we want to buy into this notion that there are particular virtues that relate to, you know, women, I think we should probably be sceptical about that. Again, I think I've still avoided answering your question.
I think I've avoided answering the question myself ever since it first arose. What does it mean to be a father? What does it mean to be a real man?
It's tough, yeah. But
one thing that I have observed just through speaking to other fathers is that the experience for fathers of raising a son versus the experience of raising a daughter seems to be profoundly different, not just in terms of the challenges and issues that they face, but in terms of how it shapes the type of father that they are. So from what we're saying, it becomes really hard to know why that occurs. Is it because of social messages around how one ought to raise particular genders, or is it because there is something different that we owe to our sons versus what we do owe to our daughters as parents?
Can it be both? Can I have a bet each way on that? I mean, I think it is both. It is kind of partly constructed by our social circumstances, and partly it is because we do, you know, owe different things to children in, you know, of different sexes. I mean, with respect to raising a daughter, I feel like I have to show her how it's possible, you know, in this culture, in these circumstances, in these times, to live a good life as a female. And the challenges faced by females in our society are different from those faced by men. And I'm not saying they're more difficult. They're just a different set of challenges.
Look, Nin, thank you so much for answering some of my questions and not answering
some
others. I really appreciate your time. Thank you so much for joining us.
That's a pleasure, Matt. Thanks so much.
Virtue ethics can be a confronting way of thinking. The Greek word for virtue was arete, which means excellence. And this is basically what virtue ethics demands of us. We should aim for excellence. As a parent, when you're sleep deprived, overwhelmed, or juggling five different obligations at once, it can be hard to ask for excellence. Perhaps instead we should aim for what psychologist Donald Winnicott called the good enough parent. So long as we're virtuous enough to show our children how to live well, we can forgive ourselves for the odd indiscretion. But we're not done with the ancient Greeks yet. They believed that the purpose of human life was to flourish. Does parenting help us with flourishing, or does it get in the way? Next time, we'll talk parenting and happiness on The Philosopher's Zone.
We sure will. Matthew Beard on the philosophy of parenting. And Matthew will be back next week for the fourth and final part in the series. Thanks this week to producer Diane Dean. I'm David Rutledge. You've been in the Philosopher's Zone, and I'll see you next time.